Hello, Oregon Hemp Convention. I know I have friends here in the audience and that don't want me to speak to a mostly empty crowd. So if you're friends with Bradley Steinman, come sit down. Water law and cannabis. What could water possibly have to do with a plant? Well, my name is Bradley Steinman. I'm an attorney here in Oregon. I used to be an intern in law school for John Lucey IV, a normal committee member and Oregon marijuana attorney. Then I was also an intern for Lee Berger, the dude who wrote the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and was a founding member of Voter Power and helped get the OMA passed. He also helped write Measure 91. And getting to work for Lee helped me to be able to do political stuff, and I was able to help out the last couple legislative sessions with some of that, with getting dispensaries legalized and regulating the supply system and working on Measure 91. I got to write one line in it and help out with some of the finalized language at like the 30th draft. So I started my own law firm, and it's Green Business Law LLC. I focus on cannabis law in Oregon, and I'm here to help people become legal and get in compliance and hopefully sooner than later make lots of money and change the world. So what are the ingredients in growing a healthy live plant? Well, there's dirt or nutrients, and then there's light, either from the sun or from possibly a lamp. Or an LED light or that sort of thing. And then the third ingredient would be H2O, water. Measure 91, section 1, the very first thing after it says be enacted by the people of the state of Oregon is some purposes and intent that kind of line up with the Cole Memorandum's 8 federal policy priority interests for federal law enforcement. And that's intentional. Has to do with some federal preemption stuff and constitutional law. It's technical. Nobody really cares but me. But the point of it is that right off the bat, what's Measure 91 and legalization about? It's about eliminating the problems caused by the uncontrolled manufacture or production, cultivation, of marijuana. That means unlicensed, unregulated, not controlled, no counting, no quantity, no sort of security, and just complete lack of regulation and oversight by the government. And the goal of legalizing is to remedy that. And why? Because the people of the state of Oregon intend that the state law should prevent the growing of marijuana on public lands and the attendant public safety and environmental dangers posed by marijuana production on public lands. And basically, this means, you know, 30,000 plant gardens in national forests, state forests, the state waters being infiltrated with waste, and, you know, basically preventing environmental degradation. If legalizing cannabis means that there's going to be a negative effect on the environment, it's not worth legalizing. So to me, it's very important. So what are the environmental externalities of unregulated cannabis production? We'll talk about that. But one thing that I wanted to point out, water, especially fresh water, is a finite resource. And as it turns out, we're experiencing one of the most severe droughts in history, in hundreds of years, all along the West Coast. It's gotten worse progressively since about 2011-12. When I-502 passed in Washington and Amendment 64 in Colorado, it was less of an issue than CO2 emissions from indoor grows and energy efficiency sort of issues. Water was kind of not really being talked about. But since that time, water law issues have really come to the forefront because of these incredible droughts. And, you know, if you look at this picture, you'll see how much of Oregon this last summer was declared to be in an emergency drought situation by Governor Brown. So unregulated cultivation, which is what we want to avoid, that's why we have Section 19 of Measure 91, That's why we have section 475304 of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. That's the grower registration provision. And that's why we have section 81 of HB 3400. So we're trying to avoid the threat of environmental degradation that was the result of national and state cannabis prohibition. If you are not regulating and legalizing, and people are just putting soil amendments and nitrates and whatever they're putting into their soil all over the place, they're leaving a bunch of stuff, and they're sucking up water from places they shouldn't be and polluting it right back out, and they're not being, you know, they're not implementing environmental best practices. They're not careful about their discharging of waste, and there's no oversight of what they're doing. They're going to grow as much as they can, and they're probably going to be related to like a DTO, you know, an international drug trafficking organization. And all they're doing is trying to make as much money as possible and skirt the law as much as possible. You know, the environment means nothing to them, and they don't care about, you know, the harm to wildlife. They don't care about polluting rivers that people get their drinking water somehow related to or from. They don't care about killing endangered species. And they don't care about our health or the health of the environment. So there's a potential for devastating impacts on water quality, public health, wildlife, and the environment from cannabis prohibition. And what we want to do is regulate it. That's what we're doing as a state. And we want to show the federal government and show ourselves that this experiment in legalization can work. And one of the measures of that, not just according to me, but according to the federal government in the Cole memo, is going to be whether or not our state is doing an adequate job of protecting the environment. This is a picture of Lake Shasta. You see that? When I came to Oregon in 2010, I drove to San Francisco for the first time with Sam Chapman to go to Oaksterdam University and attend Students for Sensible Drug Policy National Strategy Summit. And aside from getting to get high with Richard Lee, which was awesome, before Oaksterdam got raided, I got to pass by beautiful Lake Shasta, which if you go back to the previous slide, Brian, could you go back? That's what it looked like when I drove by the first time. There was people boating, there was sailboats, it was just this beautiful park, just amazingly gorgeous atmosphere. I couldn't believe how wonderful it looked. I'm from Illinois and went to college in Indiana. We didn't have stuff like mountains and beautiful parks like this. And, you know, it's being on the West Coast that really, you know, gets me going and excited. I love the environment out here. That's one of the reasons I live here. And I just thought it was so beautiful. And then, like, 2 years later, 3 years later, I was going down to San Francisco for the California Normal Conference a little bit after Measure 80 failed in the 2012 election. It was like January, February. And I missed corporate income tax class to go to this normal conference with Lee Berger and some other people. And on the way there, it looked like this when I drove by the same place. I went right over that bridge, and it was mind-blowing. It's absolutely amazing how severe the drought is. And it's not bullshit. It's serious in Oregon, and it's more severe in California and in their Central Valley. And it's very much a debatable thing to what degree, you know, unregistered, unlicensed grows in California in the, you know, Emerald Triangle region. Their siphoning of water is leading to this sort of thing. You know, Lake Shasta is like a reservoir, and they could kind of pick and choose how much water they're going to drain. But I was driving around Mendocino County on an unrelated excursion to California, and I was shocked by how many dry riverbeds I saw with just like nary a little tiny stream where there used to be a big raging river, and you could see, you know, the sedimentary layers of how recently there used to be, you know, healthy, you know, environmentally strong rivers and, you know, watersheds and things of this nature. And it's just very sad what's going on. All right. So this is why water law is important. We also need water to live as humans. We can't drink salt water. And I don't want to be like Bear Grylls. Oh, gross. Sorry. All right. I'm going to introduce to y'all now a colleague of mine from law school. This is my friend Brian Sheets. He is a water law expert. He used to work for the United States Attorney's Office and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. He was on the Lewis and Clark Law School Law Review. So pretty much in every way, he impresses me. And aside from my depth of experience with cannabis law, this is something that I would really kind of defer to him. And on the water law stuff that I've worked on for clients, Brian's been a great resource for me because, you know, you'll be able to confer with other attorneys. So I'm pleased to introduce and honored to share the stage with my friend Brian Sheets. Give it up for Brian.
Hey, thanks, Brad. I really appreciate it. So I just want to give my thanks for the invitation, the ability, and the ability to address people here. So what I'm going to talk about real quick is just about Oregon water rights. And so Oregon water, it starts from the principle that all of the water belongs to the people of Oregon. And the Oregon Water Resources Department and the state is able to give people the ability to use that water for specific purposes. So to be able to use the water, you either have to have a permit from the state to be able to use that or to fall within an exemption. So to apply for a that's how you get your water. And you have your primary appropriators. Those are the people who are getting water directly from the environment, whether that be from a well, whether that be from surface water, or if you're able to possibly collect it from natural rainwater. But the state is very interested in where all the water goes and where it comes from. So you want to make sure that any sort of operation you're doing, it has a firm supply of water, and then that water fits within the use that the state has in mind. So your primary appropriators get it directly from the natural resource. Your secondary appropriators are going to be if you get it from, like, a municipality. So the municipality is the initial appropriator, whether it has well permits, well water certificates, or if they have a stream diversion that they're getting their water from. So, and the way that people get their water is through their applications for a water rights permit. That's your initial starting point. So you'll identify the location and the source of water that you want to use. You apply to the Oregon Water Resources Department, and if it's an approved use and there's water available, they'll go through a review process, and the next thing you'll get is a water supply permit. So the water supply permit gives you the ability to develop that water and apply it to beneficial use. And so beneficial use is using it in agriculture, using it for domestic purposes, using it for recreation purposes. Right, there's all sorts of different uses for water. Storage rights, fire suppression, all kinds of different uses. And those kind of uses have to be explained to the department so that they understand where the water is going, how much water is available. Because the next guy who comes down the line is going to want to know if there's water available, and the Water Resources Department is going to say, yeah, either it's available or it's not. Another important use that has caught on within the past three, four decades is in-stream water rights. And those are water, and that's water that's reserved to stay in the stream for the benefit of fish and wildlife. So these are some very important balances that the Water Resources Department is trying to understand. They want to make sure that there's enough water for people to use for their grow operations, for their agricultural needs, for their domestic water supplies. But they also want to make sure that there's enough water for the muskrats and for the salmon. Salmon's a real big hot issue, especially when it comes to tribal interests because of treaty rights. So it's a pretty complex balance, and this whole department has its own priority listing, and that's what makes going through the department so interesting. Oregon's a prior appropriation state. That means that the first person to use that water beneficially and to receive a water rights certificate has priority in times of scarcity. First in time, first in right. So if you have a water rights certificate and you've gone through the perfection process, that's called the gold standard of having secured access to water. And so, yeah.
All right, thank you, Brian. We're going to try to do it a little informally and pass it back and forth. So water law and cannabis, Until recently, marijuana was regulated exclusively kind of at a criminal level, even in the state of Oregon. We had the Oregon Health Authority that has its OMMP program, which is just a card registry program. They would take in applications, and if people qualified and they submitted, you know, a fee, they had the proper recommendation, a qualifying condition, and all that, then they would be issued a card and a set of cards if they had a caregiver and a grower. And there was OHA, the health authority, who had the mandate, really, to make all the rules necessary to implement and regulate marijuana in the state. And then beyond that, it was, you're no longer exempt from state criminal prosecution, and it became a criminal law matter. When I started working for John Lucey and Lee Berger, it was, you know, a lot of criminal defense cases. It was not civil in the way that it has been since 2013 when HB 3460 passed. But now, or go back please for a second. Now with HB 3400, water law and environmental regulations really are going to be an increasingly prevalent and important aspect of legal cannabis, of just this world that we live in. So we have wastewater law, and this is being, you know, implemented by the DEQ. We have a cannabis production and processing nexus in HB 3400, where if you want to get licensed, period, to be able to commercially produce for adult use under Measure 91, you're going to have to take into account water law and your water usage and come up with a report as part of being able to be eligible for the issuance of a license from OLCC, period. Water rights are going to be increasingly important. If you don't have a perfected water right in the way that Brian went through that process, and I've done a lot of educating myself recently and also with the help of folks like Brian, but I didn't know the first thing about it, and it's becoming incredibly important. And, you know, my practice, I imagine, is going to go more in this direction. Another thing is these land use compatibility statements, or a LUX, and we're going to go over that. So this is kind of the outline, basically, of our presentation. There's water usage reporting requirements, as we said, and a plethora of state and local government agency regulators. And the future of legal cannabis and environmental regulation is going to be largely in the hands of this task force that's written into HB 3400. And all of this stuff was not directly in Measure 91. And the legislature went in the direction of taking environmental law and water law into, you know, a high priority and added all this stuff in there. So this is the thing that people are going to have to be aware of. And I'm going to hand it back to my friend, Mr. Sheets.
All right, so in HB 3400, there's a report that talks about the electrical and the water usage. So what that does is it sort of pinpoints that there's a thought and a definite intent to make sure that grow operations, cultivators, the whole industry sort of is compliant with Oregon water law, because that's one of the main, as Brad explained earlier, one of the main concerns was of these illegal grows that had these adverse environmental impacts. They had runoff going into salmon streams, and it's a big priority. And if you have those sort of externalities that go out, it's not going to be good for the environment. It's not going to be good for the industry. And so being able to make sure that you're able to navigate those sort of issues, your inputs, where you get your water from, and your outputs from where your water goes. Because as we all know, production has inputs and outputs. Sometimes the input's your product, and sometimes the output is the byproducts. Yeah.
And I want to add real quick. So why does it matter that there's a water usage report as part of your application to be a commercial producer under Section 19 of Measure 91? That's the grower license. There's this aspect of Measure 91 where we want to kind of protect the existing or extant legal industry that's developed around our medical program. And we are kind of taking the path of instituting a who's done the best, who deserves it. It's not a lottery-based system like in Washington. We're doing a merit-based system, and that was written into Measure 91. And this is the sort of thing that furthers that. So if you're a medical grower currently, and you're thinking about doing the opt-in, under HB 3400, where a medical grower, if they get the authorization from all of their patients and they do some other things, then they can get licensed automatically by the OLCC. Anybody, period, that's a medical grower now or thinking about getting that commercial production license, one of the things that they have to take into account is water usage and being able to come up with a report to satisfy the OLCC.
Right, so health and safety standards and industry best practices, those are terms that typically fall in line with the Clean Water Act. And those are called best management practices. The Clean Water Act is really the backbone of water quality discharges. Clean Water Act goes and enforces the discharge of a pollutant from a point source into the waters of the United States. So there's about six different legal elements within that sort of definition, thousands of pages of litigation about it. Right. So a point source is a confined tube, a canal, a pipe, and that it discharges into the water of the United States. There's a lot of interest right now going on about what is the waters of the United States with the new EPA and Corps of Engineers interpretive rule. But it's different from non-point source pollution. And what non-point source pollution is, it's like runoff from an agricultural operation. So it's things that are not necessarily confined to a tube, but it's diffuse and it's more ethereal. It sort of finds its way in there, and it's more difficult. There was a case about if a cattle operation was a point source pollution. It turns out that the Supreme Court finds that the back end of a cow is not a point source because it's inherently mobile. So there's different ways to think about it. So the typical point source pollution is a culvert going into a river. The non-point source pollution is basically everything else. And the feds are really interested in regulating the point sources. The states have the responsibility to implement best management practices for the non-point source pollution. So these are your agricultural operations, your grazing yards, but it's different from a confined animal feeding operation, which is by its own definition and has been written into the Clean Water Act as a point source. All right, so yeah, there's a task force, and Brad's.
All right, this is the way we're kind of doing it. All right, so Section 132 of HB 3400 establishes a task force on cannabis environmental best practices. And what is relevant about this is that by next year, around September, they are going to come up with recommendations for legislation, and they're going to be able to have input into what the OLCC's rules actually are. And what they're going to be responsible for is the studying of electricity and water use by and the agricultural practices associated with the growing of cannabis by persons who hold a license under Section 19 to be a commercial producer under Measure 91, or to be a grower, aka a person responsible for a marijuana grow site under ORS 475304, that's the marijuana grower provision in the OMA, which is also modified by Section 81 and some other sections of HB 3400. But this task force is going to be responsible for recommending environmental best practices for the state and basically have a huge amount of input into the future of how marijuana is grown in terms of big outdoor grows, indoor grows, in terms of the propagation of immature plants and maybe the nursery industry. And this task force is going to make recommendations for legislation to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly, essentially what the Measure 91 committee was. That's who they're going to be reporting to, whatever that committee's makeup is in the near future. And it's also going to include some members of the legislature themselves. So to talk about a land use compatibility statement, which is one of the requirements for getting yourself any sort of Measure 91 license, whether it's going to be under Section 19, 20, 21, or 22, you're going to be a wholesaler, producer, processor, or retailer. One of the things that you're going to have to get is a land use compatibility statement issued from a local government saying that your proposed land use is authorized in that local government's jurisdiction. Marijuana is now a farm use. Cannabis is described now as a crop, and marijuana growing is agricultural activity. But the main thing we have to understand is that under Section 34, you have to be able to get yourself issued a LUX. And a LUX is going to come through the OLCC. When you apply, the OLCC has to request it from the local government. But there's a lot you can do now and to make yourself prepared and make sure you're zoned properly and that what you're doing is appropriate for where you're at in terms of environmental stuff, but also in terms of, okay, are you commercially zoned, industrial, agricultural? If you're a dispensary, you could be zoned agricultural. But the interesting thing is that there's also an exemption, right? You know how local governments can ban? They can ban everything but medical gardens and your four plants. Beyond that, cities and counties pretty much have an avenue to ban everything. And they all have the authority to basically ban all of the Measure 91 licenses. And there's an exemption, a very narrow exemption, for if you were registered with the state as a medical marijuana facility or dispensary by July 1st of this year. So if by July 1st, the day that marijuana became legal for everyone, you were already registered with the state, and the other half of this equation, you get yourself a land use compatibility statement from a local government, then local bans do not apply to you, and you are exempt. So there's that aspect of it, and then moving forward, there's if you want to get a commercial producer or all those, you know, Measure 91 licenses, the LUX is going to be a requirement. And somebody who's more familiar with LUX than myself, because really the first time I started seeing this stuff was relatively recently, you know, during the legislative process this year, I'm going to have my friend Brian talk to you more about LUX in general.
Just to check, how are we on time? We're way over. Gotcha. Awesome. Thank you so much. Right. So yeah, if anybody has any questions, we're available after this, and then we'll also have a was it 2 o'clock in the education room. All right. So what a land use compatibility statement is from your local. From your local jurisdiction. So whether your property is located within the jurisdiction of a city, within its city limits, that's who your local jurisdiction is. And if it's outside of it, it's going to be your county. So something like this will be coming through either the county planning department or the city planning department. So what I've seen, I sit on my local planning commission, and I have an opportunity to go through some of these different hearings and figure out what the different businesses are coming through. And so what it is making sure that the use that is proposed matches with the zoning, and that's basically about it. But within that zoning, you can have uses that are either outright permitted uses, and there's typically within the county or city code, there's a list in their development code that says what are outright uses. And then there's also a list that says what are conditional uses. And so what's been going on a lot recently is that a lot of these cities and counties have been going through their development codes and adding in dispensaries, processing operations, grow operations within these different zones. And what the cities have been doing is they've been amending their development code to place reasonable time, place, and restriction matters on the different aspects of the grow operation, the dispensaries, or the distribution places. So the land use compatibility study says that this is a compatible use. It's been approved through either the planning department or it's been through a hearing with the planning commission. Once you get the land use compatibility statement, that goes along with your application to get your Measure 91 license.
And it's actually the OLCC that is charged with getting the LUX from a local government. And we don't know if that's the sort of thing that might change in February after people's applications have gone out. There's a short session coming up. But Brian's insight into LUX is certainly very valuable, with him sitting on a planning commission and actually getting to do this thing on the day-to-day. He's been an excellent resource for me, and I just want to emphasize and try to welcome him into the cannabis world and community. I think he's a valuable resource. So Section 115 is the grower opt-in for medical. If you get your patients all to authorize you, then you can go into commercial production, and there's some restrictions there. But one of the main things that you agree to be subject to Section 34 of HB 3400, Section 34 being the land use compatibility statement requirement that we just went over in the last slide. And that's what we wanted to point out with there. So next slide, please. We can go fast with this. Basically, the OMA used to be that only the Oregon Health Authority could make rules. There was no power for local governments, period, to regulate the medical use of marijuana as defined. That went from production, et cetera. And a couple years ago, when cities and counties tried to start either banning or, you know, more stringently regulating marijuana production for medical uses than the state was doing, we got to send them demand letters saying, you can't do that. State law preempts. Unfortunately or fortunately, things have changed, and now local governments have the authority to impose reasonable time, place, and manner regulations. I think it's appropriate. Now, I'm in litigation against a lot of local governments, but I would say that it makes sense to me from a reasonable perspective that local governments should be able to say, maybe this should be here and not, you know, on Main Street and that sort of thing. Reasonable time, place, and manner means, yes, there is a right here, but we're going to have some regulation over it. So now the Oregon Health Authority is no longer the only state regulator, and that's the point of that last slide. There is a plethora of water law regulators, and this is just water law alone. When we're talking about legalizing marijuana and ending prohibition and making it a more regulated environment, we really mean it. We're going to have the Oregon Water Resources Department. We're going to have special districts and irrigation districts. There's the Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I had to deal with a case recently with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality for the first time in regards to marijuana growing and cultivation. And, you know, it's not pleasant to get hit with a fine or the potential for criminal penalties if you're doing stuff that's really egregious. There's the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which now has this LUX and this water usage report requirement. There's the Oregon Department of Agriculture, which regulates water for, you know, confined animal feeding operations and obviously irrigation and agricultural uses. And also the Oregon Health Authority does their own water regulation for healthy drinking water. And there's, of course, on the top, the Environmental Protection Agency. One that's not listed that I want to throw out there is the Drug Enforcement Administration. You can get a criminal penalty sentencing enhancement for illegal manufacturing, which just means growing under federal law, if you discharge your pollutants or waste into the waters of the United States or the waters of a state or local government. It really just has to be any public land. And that's one of the federal law enforcement priorities of the Cole Memorandum. That's going to be something that could determine whether or not your business is not only eligible to get a license by the state, but also whether or not one of your businesses is going to be able to keep and maintain its banking relationships. If you want to get a banking checking account going for your business, and in the bank doing their due diligence that they're required to do under the Bank Secrecy Act and the Patriot Act, and the anti-money laundering statutes and unlicensed money remitter statutes, they're going to see if you're violating any of the 8 federal law enforcement priorities. And, oh my gosh, water law and environmental degradation and harms is one of the 8 most important things that they're going to look for. And they will close your account or prevent you from being able to open an account and basically impede your ability, period, to operate a legal business if you don't take this stuff into account. So it's not just us who think it's an important thing. It's really important to the development of the legal industry. Brian.
Right. So what are some of the things that the DEQ is really interested about? Well, there's a... All right, we're going to wrap it up here really quick, but there's a whole list of what they call normal pollutants, and then they have what they call toxic pollutants. Don't discharge anything that's on the toxic pollutants. And if you're dealing with normal pollutants, watch what you're doing there too. You won't get in as much trouble as with toxic pollutants, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you mitigate any sort of traditional pollutants that are being put out either into the environment or being applied to the land. Right. So the difference between possibly growing just like a straight agricultural water use, is that you might fall under an exemption with the Clean Water Act for agricultural use. If you're doing industrial processing, such as maybe doing some extracts or some after processing of any sort, that's under industrial discharges, and those are regulated at the full level of the Clean Water Act.
Do you keep your exemption if you discharge waste? Or do you lose your
exemption? If you discharge waste, the question was if you keep your exemption if you discharge waste. There's pollutants that are going to be naturally discharged through your agricultural enterprise, and those fall within an exemption. I mean, the history behind that is thousands and thousands of acres of corn being grown in the Midwest. Any sort of traditional farming, they want to make sure that farmers are able to maintain a healthy food supply for the nation. So that's the background on that. If your operation falls within that sort of traditional farming understanding, I think that you'll be able to maintain an agricultural exemption. So I think we've got to wrap it up. I just want to say thank you very much, Brad, for having me, introducing me. Great person to work with. And if anybody has any questions, we're available after.
And thank you, Brian, and thank you, Oregon Hemp Convention, for having us. It's a pleasure.